Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 81 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined by the usual collection of co-hosts. First, we have Rob Mark, Mr. Jetwine. Hi, Rob.
Hey, good evening. Well, Mr. Jetwine, I think that's the nicest thing you've ever said to me.
We've also got Dan Webb, of course, from Things in the Sky
Aleck
blog.
No smart Aleck stuff, Dan. Don't start. Don't start.
I'm just going to say hi. That's all I'm doing.
You were. I heard you snickering in the background there.
Well, because you were like, aw. So I'm sorry. Good evening. Hello. Whatever.
And we also have David Vanderhoof, the official Airplane Geeks historian, and he's also author of the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, whatever it is you do download this. Hi, guys.
You're covering all the bases, aren't you?
So wait. David gets his blog recognized and I don't. Okay, that's cool.
Actually, I did mention it, but I think Rob talked over it. Our guest this week is Alan Howell. Alan is the CEO of Corporate Flight Management. That's located in Smyrna in Nashville, Tennessee, and they offer aircraft services and charters. But Alan is also part of the Plane Conversations blog, which offers content about private jet travel. So, Alan, thanks for joining us this episode.
Hey, thanks for having me. Welcome from down south in Tennessee.
Great to have you. Also coming up, we're going to have, of course, this week's report from the Airplane Geeks Australia desk. And David will have his This Week in Aviation History segment. So we'll look forward to those. First, though, let's get started with the news.
God, I love that music.
Isn't that inspiring?
Yeah, it gets me going. Okay.
First article comes from NPR. This is Air Force brings order to Haiti airport. Now, we've got a couple of articles that we want to talk about concerning the tragic situation in Haiti. Soon after the event occurred, the earthquake occurred, the U.S. military was on site pretty quickly. In fact, the Air Force Special Operations Team was there within a few hours. But things at the airport weren't going so well, and there was a rather large jam up of flights trying to land and bring supplies and people to help with the situation. The article points out that the U.S. Air Force kind of came through with another group a little after that, an Air Force special unit whose job it is to get critical airports with operational problems up and running. So this was a 115-person Air Force team. They arrived with five C-17 cargo planes, and that was loaded with different communications and ATC equipment. And this all comes through the 621st Contingency Response Wing, a group that I really hadn't been familiar with. David, I think you looked into this a little bit, didn't you?
Yeah, Max. Actually, I was sort of surprised about the 621st Contingency Response Wing, too. I usually consider myself pretty up to date with the Air Force stuff, but the 621st is actually based out of Joint Base McGuire-Dix-Lakehurst, and it is basically designed to do what it's doing. It is a first responder for crisis management. Their job is to set up an airfield, and they were established only back in March of 2005. And I think it's basically a result of Katrina. But they have response teams scattered throughout the world. The headquartered in McGuire, New Jersey.
Right.
So the five C-17s actually was the secondary response I've discovered. The 15th Special Operations Wing actually flew in on, if it was Tuesday, it flew in on Wednesday. And they were the ones that were originally set up to starting to set up the airfield itself. Mm-hmm. Now, for some of those people who don't know, and one of the reasons why I got so irked at all this NPR coverage about them not being able to set up the airfield in a short enough time is I started studying the airfield. The airfield, Port-au-Prince Lucent-Latourville International, has a 9,974-foot runway that is only 141 feet wide, and has one apron with one taxiway, so that there is no back taxi, there is no parallel taxiway. So if you land an aircraft into that airfield, you have to back taxi to the main apron taxiway, which is almost the middle of the runway. So it's a nightmare from an administration point. There's no way. So you can't, needless to say, you can have an aircraft taxiing back as well and trying to land at the same time. If you had a parallel taxiway, you could get a lot more aircraft in there. The other issue that arrived was the aircraft that were there because of the accident had no fuel. So they had to actually fly in fuel to get the aircraft out to clear the apron space.
Ah, I see. Yeah.
So this is like the worst nightmare you could possibly have had as far as trying to recreate an airfield, because it's got an apron big enough to hold about 3 727s. And they had, when the Air Force started taking over the base, had several aircraft already on the ground, and they had gotten down but didn't have enough fuel to get out. So I likened it to a one-lane bridge. You have a one-lane bridge with traffic lights that monitor the flow across the one-lane bridge, and they're out. And in the middle of the bridge, you have a truck that has run out of gas blocking traffic on both ways. So you can't get to that truck because of the backlog. They are doing an amazing job given the circumstances they were giving. This could be the worst possible airfield that this could have happened to.
Can I throw in a side note?
Yes, of course.
Okay. Here comes a side note. My last year in the Air Force, I was in what we called a mobile communications detachment, which was the precursor to this group. And that's what we spent our time doing out of a base in Texas. And we would travel to all these godforsaken places with cargo airplanes and portable control towers and portable radar units and pretend that we were in a crisis situation, and we had to go in and within a few hours try to get air traffic services up and running. And it's amazing what one or two people can do when planes are out there trying to land. And the situation David mentions is just probably the worst that we would ever face, having no way to get airplanes back from the other end, which means, as he said, they've got to wait till the other guy clears the runway. You know, that there are people out there that are very, very good at that. And it seems like in a very short span of time, they really did grab the bull by the horns and really get it, you know, kind of knocked down. Because I've heard that the traffic has been flowing fairly decently in there now.
Well, that's good, of course. And, you know, the airlines are also contributing to the effort. We see in our next article from CNN, Airlines Organizing Haiti Earthquake Aid, that several airlines are organizing relief flights, and they're also offering customer incentives who donate to aid organizations. So, for example, American Airlines have sent several American Eagle aircraft to Haiti with relief supplies, and they have plans for more. But they're also offering the frequent flyer program members mileage incentives for making contributions to the Red Cross. And some of the other airlines are doing similar kinds of things, and we see some examples of that in the article. Spirit is going to give 5,000 free Spirit miles to the first 200,000 members of its frequent flyer program who donate at least $5 to a group of specific organizations, UNICEF, Red Cross, and some others.
I got to say, I like that. I like the idea, okay, we'll give an incentive, because that's a good cause. But I don't know what you guys think, but I think Spirit's gotten a little sleazy with this, because now their new promotion is if you sign up for our MasterCard, we'll donate $75 to charity. Which just seems to be pushing it a little bit to me.
Yeah, there is kind of a fine line, I guess, between genuine efforts to contribute something positive to this terrible situation and taking advantage of it for their own benefit. I guess it's hard to define where that line is sometimes.
But you know what else is kind of scary? I don't know if all of you have gotten many of the same things, is that right after the within maybe 2 days of the earthquake, I started getting text messages from organizations I didn't know that said, you know, click here, link here, and donate $10 to the quake relief fund. And it's kind of scary, because while I think an awful lot of people really wanted to help, I doubt seriously that some of that or that all of that was probably legal. I'm sure there were some scams in there somewhere, don't you?
Yeah, like I've now seen some like I think it was CNN. I've seen online now, you know, lists of approved organizations, and it's kind of sad that they have to do that.
So we've talked about some of the military contribution to the situation, and some of the airline contribution. Alan, how about from the general aviation standpoint? Are you seeing any activity in regards to support for the situation in Haiti?
We are. Of course, our flight operations, our director of flight operations, is pretty active in the MBAA forum. So we see a lot of activity, you know, through the MBAA. They were about, you know, maybe 24 hours before they had something up on their website. That seemed a little bit slow to say, hey, if you're, you know, if you want to donate your airplane, or if you want to contribute, here's the way to do it. Mm-hmm. and start coordinating it. So this happened, I guess, you know, Wednesday or Tuesday afternoon, as the week went on, the activity generated picked up quite a bit. I think there's a frustration, somewhat of a frustration with the business aviation community, because nobody can seem to get in down there. And understandably, the emphasis is on large airplanes and heavy lift, mm-hmm. you know, military airplanes that are coming in from all over the world. But I know of several airplanes that were turned back, you know, that had doctors on board. So there's a little bit of a frustration there from the business aviation side. And I think it's going to be an exercise in patience.
Well, it's interesting because the infrastructure there is different than what we'd see in other places, and certainly in the United States, and certainly what we saw, for example, with Katrina, right? I think it's pretty much just this one, or maybe there's one other airport in Haiti, and they don't have a sort of an infrastructure of general aviation airports that could accommodate flights coming in, right?
Yeah, you've got a country of 9 million people. And I've been down there three times. We partner up with a gentleman there who leases regional airline equipment, and that's one of the businesses we're in, is maintenance of regional airline turboprops. And so we've been down there to visit him. You've got the big airport there. You've got Cap Haitien on the north side of the island, which has got something like an 8,000-foot runway, but when they built it, they, in the middle of the runway, I think they started from both ends, and when they got to the middle, they were about a foot off. So, from an engineering standpoint, you've only got 4,000 usable feet. So these guys fly, you know, LET 410s and Jetstreams, you know, Twin Otters, Caravans out of Port-au-Prince over to Cap Haitien. That's the only other, I think that's the only other runway that would be big enough for anything other than a STOL type airplane in a country of 9 million people. It's amazing. Of course, it's a poor country, and you know they haven't had the money to build that type of infrastructure, but there's a lot of questions to ask about that, you know, the what ifs.
Okay, Rob, did you want to add anything?
Well, I was just going to say that I know NBAA has been, you know, fairly deeply involved in that, and I think the biggest frustration, in fact, I just had a friend call me just before the show started here that's representing a number of Dassault airplanes that are trying to get into Haiti, and they have been unable to get off the ground as well. So I wonder, we're sitting here obviously a couple thousand miles away, but
right,
you know, I wonder how much you know, good we're going to be able to do if the feds and the Air Force decide that they want, you know, more C-17s and more 767s and what have you in there than say Falcons. And you know, I watched them loading up an Astra, and they were just stuffing stuff in the seats and pilot in the aisles and everything just to get the stuff down there. But one thing I did hear is that initially they were having trouble with business airplanes because people were trying to get on board the airplanes to get out. You know, they were just down there to deliver supplies, and people said, "No, you're not leaving without us." And so that became kind of a problem. But I think it sounds like they've got it fixed, but still I'm not sure how many airplanes are. And you know, that might be something you can elaborate for us on Alan, is that I'm not sure how many airplanes are actually getting in on the BizAv side. Are there many?
You know, I don't think there's anybody tracking it, but I know some pretty high profile people that tried to get in even as late as Friday. And one was a Falcon 50 who left out of North Carolina, flew all the way down there, held for 2 hours, and then had to fly back to Miami. And so, I think more are not getting in than are getting in. We've had a lot of requests from our flight department to make trips down there tomorrow, or I'll say Monday. We've got a plane going down, but we're just going to the Dominican Republic. We're going into Santo Domingo, and I think what they're going to do there is either charter a helicopter or sit there and see until they can get a ride on one of the little regional airliners that flies over there, because it's just, you know, with airplanes, some of the airplanes we operate, we can't even go try because we can't afford to hold for 2 hours. And then even if we did land and there's no fuel, then you're stuck. So it's a pretty limiting situation right now. Hopefully hopefully over time that settles down. Hopefully this week they'll get a feel for it as kind of the initial push gets over with.
Well, I don't know the geography down there, but if they do land in the Dominican, what's the status of roads between the two countries? I mean, is it pretty limited?
If you can imagine, the island has got a huge mountain chain that separates the two countries.
Ah.
And for all intents and purposes, you've got two roads that go from one side of the island to the other. So getting the stuff to the Dominican Republic is just as bad as getting it to the airport and not getting it off the airport, because it's one of those you can't get there from here.
I see.
You know, I was, as I thought of this in the last few days and looking at it and then thinking about, you know, USA Today and what it seems like their attacks against general aviation and especially against small airports. And they've been highlighting some of extreme cases where airports have gotten federal funding maybe when they shouldn't have, but trying to say that's a systemic problem versus a one-off problem. You know, maybe this will silence those guys, because if Haiti had, and I'll just say in comparison, in Tennessee here we have 6 million people in the state. We're geographically maybe the size of the whole island down there. But we've got 74, 76 public airports. Every person in this state lives within 30 minutes of an airport. And every one of those airports is capable of handling a business jet. And if you had just three more airports in that country that were 5,000-foot runways, even if they were VFR airports, in a situation like this, how many more, you know, of those business jets who are carrying doctors?
Right.
I think that's a lot of what, you know, the business jet market, the business aviation and general aviation people are carrying teams of surgeons and doctors down there who could be there in that first 72 hours, and how many lives would they save? And if you look at what's going on there versus what we have in this country, it just lets you know that you know, the small airports in this country are way underappreciated, and comparing it against what happened at Katrina, you know, where the whole country seemed to get in uproars because it seemed like a slow response.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, compared to this, you know, you had all those airports in southern Louisiana and Mississippi that were open within a day and could take that traffic to come in there to provide help. So It's an interesting contrast, and you know, maybe some of the money that flows down there for aid may help in building infrastructure, not just airports, but decent roads.
Right, exactly. Well put. All right, moving on to another topic. This is from the Wichita Eagle. Tighter airline security could increase business jet use. This article suggests that after the attempted bombing of the Northwest flight, that tighter security might spur some business travelers to switch from the major airlines to smaller business jets. There's a quote from Robert Mann. He's an airline consultant. He says, "It is a preferred mode of transportation for people who have a high value of time and a high value of convenience." but not everyone is kind of agrees with him. Ed Bolin, Ed, of course, is the CEO of the NBAA. He said that we did not see any empirical data to show a significant shift to business aviation after 9/11. So I guess there's a little difference of opinion. What do you all think? Do you think that the increased security, the longer lines, is that going to contribute to a shift to business jet use?
Tell you the truth, I'm not sure how much it would affect business jet use in the sense that how many people can afford that. But I mean, I think security can definitely have an effect on travelers' choices, especially in the short haul market. So I mean, I'm not sure how much hard data there is, but I'm convinced that one factor that has really hurt the Northeast shuttle routes is the fact that, okay, well, now after 9/11, we have to get to the airport so early, and combine that with Amtrak improving Acela so much, mm-hmm. You're not going to use that. So could it hurt? Absolutely. I don't think there's going to be a huge increase in business jet use out of this, though.
Well, you know, I don't know. Maybe I'm the eternal optimist and on the side here. But you know, after 9/11, and maybe Alan, you can confirm this. I mean, there was definitely a significant uptick in the use of charter because of just the reasons we're talking about. And however, this time we have something that's balancing it off, and the business aviation has still not overcome the fallout from the big three auto guys that bailed out on their airplanes last year
right,
ago
right.
fall, and right. so I think that may factor in there somehow. But and Dan, in terms of the people that can afford it, I mean, you're absolutely right. But I think even in charter, there weren't people that were just trying to go see grandma that were chartering a Citation. I mean, these are people that had the means to do it anyway, and I think that when that opportunity arises, I think they're going to take it. I guess that the hard data is something, it's a little tougher to come up with in this industry.
Well, I think over time, it's just part of an accumulating effect where travelers, the business travelers especially, or what we would say is the high-end business travelers, just it's just one more piece of a system that is a major time killer. And so, either people will get out of the airplane, out of the airline, and they drive. And we've seen a lot of that in markets where, that's that short haul market that I think Dan was mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
But the hassle factor, the bigger the hassle factor, I'd say, pick off that very top high-end business traveler who rides on the airline and also may occasionally charter. I think they're going to charter more and ride on the airline less. They're never going to totally give up the airline, but they're sure going to avoid it when they can justify it, when they've got a group of people going in the same direction, or for whatever reason the airline pricing is higher, and so charter makes more sense from a pure economy standpoint.
And I think one other thing you have to consider here is right now most of the security measures are only applicable to international flights inbound to the United States. So I'm not sure how much that affects that kind of limits the number of people that are going to be affected right now.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have to see what happens once the TSA figure out what the heck it's doing with this. But anyway.
All right. Well, we've seen that the security issues, which apply to the airlines at airports, are not unique to them. We've seen the TSA look to general aviation and smaller airports as well in the past. We have an article from General Aviation News. TSA launches GA vulnerability assessment. And it turns out that the 9/11 Commission, in its Recommendations Act of 2007, actually directed the TSA, according to this article, to develop and implement a standardized threat and vulnerability assessment program for general aviation airports. So the TSA is launching this, and this is a survey, according to this article, allows general aviation airport operators to assess the current level of security at their airport. It's a survey. I'm not sure, what happens with the data that comes from the survey. Alan, are you familiar with this?
Not directly. The two airports we operate out of with fixed-based operations,
Right.
Both have you know, security to the level of a 139, you know, commercial airport.
Hmm.
But then go, you know, 20 miles down the road to one of the smaller airports, and you can still walk out on the, you know, you can still walk out on the tarmac.
Right.
With no badge or anything. So, but I'm not, you know, past the survey stage, what they do with it, that's a little scary.
Yeah.
Sure, and this has been coming for a while. I mean, this is not exactly a shock. I mean, and I think Alan's point is well taken. I mean, if you look at the survey, it's actually very – it's not asking really sensitive questions. I mean, it of course, I almost worry about even mentioning it because I don't want to end up like Steve and Chris and have the feds banging on my door. But I don't think there's anything there that's really scary. But it is interesting because they don't tell you what they're going to do with the data. I mean, there's no mention of that at all.
Right. Well, if you're interested in actually looking at the survey, that's available online. According to this this article, you can find it at tsa.gov/GA survey.
By the way, though, the one I did take the survey, I put your name in it, Max.
Oh, wonderful. Now they're going to be knocking at my door.
What's that I hear in the background, Max?
There they are, knocking at the door.
See, Australians, we have sound effects too.
And Alan, when you hear the podcast from the guys down under, even if you really like it, don't tell us that you did.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, I have an Australian working for me. She's from Queensland, so I'm fond of Australians.
Oh, great. Good.
I think everyone should have a couple.
Yeah.
We have ours. Right?
Yes, that's right. We're doing our part for, you know, good U.S. relations. We have our Australians.
That sounds really bad. I think I'm going to take that.
Everyone needs a couple token Australians. It's just
That's right.
And, we embrace diversity here.
That's right. We couldn't get Kang.
They're such friendly people, too.
And if we could just get Grant and Steve to get us a couple of roux, I think we'd be fine. So,
what would you do with a roux?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm a dog guy. I mean, I figure they
kangaroos, they, dogs, all the same thing.
Kangaroo.
Right?
Well, actually, the neighbors call ours the Critter House. So,
Rob would be the one that tries to, you know, fit in the pocket of the kangaroo.
I don't think that's going to work.
Dan, I don't like where this is going.
Okay, so we'll move on to the next story. This is from Business
Good
Week.
Idea.
U.S. Airlines may raise fares and fees further in 2010 profit bid. Article says that Delta, United, and Continental Airlines are all raising the cost to check a first and second bag. This is after the previous $20 increase in the round-trip fuel charge on flights between the U.S. and Europe. There's a consultant. There's always a consultant, right? Jay Sorensen. He's from IdeaWorks, and he's also a former Midwest Airlines executive. His quote is, they're using bag fees as a lever against cost increases, namely oil. Article points out that through the third quarter in 2009, airlines collected at least $2 billion through ancillary charges, that according to the Bureau of Transportation Statistics.
What's the story exactly? I mean, that they're raising fees to make money? Isn't that their job?
Well, yeah. the past week and a half has been let's all raise bag fees collectively week.
But they do everything collectively.
Yeah. Well, it was just funny because for a while at the airport, U.S. Airways was in the high realm, so they charged. Let me think. 25 for the first bag at the airport and 35 for the second bag at the airport. But you could save $5. On each bag, if you checked it online, then Delta decided, oh, we're going to raise ours for the first bag from. See, it's so confusing. They raised theirs to 25 and 35 beside level. Instead of doing the $5 discount, you only save $2 on the first bag if you check it in online, and $3 if you check in the second bag online. So then Continental United matched Delta, and then US Airways said, well, we'll reduce the discount online. So then American right now is the lowest with 20 and 30 flat. And
that would be Southwest is the lowest?
Well, of those who charge fees, and then Southwest doing bags fly free. And as anyone who has ever watched a football game this season knows, they've been pretty aggressive with that. So we'll see. Southwest is now saying that they're actually gaining market share as a result. So we'll have to see how that goes.
My theory is that the airlines want it to be confusing. That they
it's like the fare structure.
Exactly. Well, the fare structure used to be incredibly confusing, and you hardly knew what other options you have. But you know, as we've seen with the introduction of internet sites that provide ticket pricing and so forth, the flyers go right to the lowest price ticket. So my theory is this is a way to get back to kind of the old market dynamics where it was confusing and they could try to sell tickets on the basis of things other than just purely cost.
When my lovely wife flew to Orlando with her sister-in-law on AirTran, it was cheaper for them to fly first class because if they flew first class and did the upgrade to first class,
Okay.
Their bags would fly free. So they paid the $30 a person to have their to sit in first class and have cocktails so they could their bags, which would have been more than that, fly home.
Well,
it doesn't make any sense.
I think that some airlines are trying to make it easier. In this, for example, United, you can buy a yearly subscription. And
to
that
what? My bags are us?
Yes. And that'll just cover your bag fees for the year. And then obviously you still have if you're elite, you're going to be exempt. But one interesting thing I have heard is one reason the airlines might like charging the fees is if I'm an airline, I raise my fares, the tax I'm going to collect on the fare also goes up, so the total cost goes up. Apparently, that is fees aren't taxed that way. So the airlines like that area as well. So I just found that interesting.
Yeah, the IRS will jump in there and figure that out real quick.
I believe I actually read an article that Congress wants to change that, which, they'll always find the government will always find new and inventive ways to make money. So,
what was interesting is that I took a – I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you, Dan. I got
No. You do it all the time. It's okay.
Okay. That's okay. I got over that pretty quick. But you know what's interesting is I carried a bag on to a – What are we in Rome?
Yeah. Thumbs down.
Wow. The crowds are getting ugly here. Yeah. I mean, but you know the good thing about that means we have more listeners than we thought.
They've snuck onto the podcast somehow.
Yeah, they snuck onto the podcast. I carried a bag onto an airplane a couple of weeks ago, and they said, well, there's no room in the overheads, and you're going to have to check it. And I thought, oh, God, because I honestly didn't want to pay the $30 or whatever it was at the time. So they just took my bag at the front door and walked it down the stairs, stuffed it in the back, and then it was there when I came back. And I said, how much do I owe you? And she said, you don't owe us anything.
Yeah, no.
Said, really? Is that cool?
Yeah. So when I flew Midwest and Frontier 2 weeks ago, when I had relatively full flights, the overhead space went away very quickly, and you had to gate check, and that's an issue operationally because now you're wasting time on the ground.
Uh huh.
So that's something that the airlines do have to consider. If now you can't leave on time anymore, what happens now? So,
and they can't penalize you for making the decision. Not for you to not be able to. I mean, in all fairness, they can't penalize you because you are taking the luggage on the airplane and they're making the decision post that it can't stay on the airplane and it needs to fly underneath. Good customer service.
Yeah, I mean, as long as it's the proper size for the overhead bin, you should have a reasonable expectation that there's room for it. So,
So I hope none of our listeners try that.
Yeah,
because that would be completely circumventing the marketing strategy of a number of legacy carriers.
Well, that's one thing that's come up is are the airlines interested in putting sizers at security? So if you have a really big bag and you're trying to avoid paying the bag fee, will that be allowed in? So I don't think they'll do that. But yeah, no. On my recent trips, I go with a carry on if I can. It's just getting out of the airport a lot faster to boot. So.
But you always fly first class anyway, right?
But no.
But I thought you knew everybody at the airlines.
Alan, this is another reason why you should choose charters, correct?
That's absolutely. I love all this stuff these guys are doing. It makes us happy when they get confusing like this.
Well, the good thing is, what the airlines have done to make the top-tier business traveler happy, if you're buying full fare economy, which no one does, but or business or first class, you are exempt from these fees. to try to make keep them happy. And the same thing with the elite members.
Hmm. So then the free drink and the free... Yeah, the free drink and the free bags cost you about an extra $400 at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, if you're frequent business traveler, 25,000 miles in a year isn't that much, so that you'll be exempt from that quickly. Granted, I still think they're annoying, but that they will be here to stay, unless this is an incredibly successful for Southwest. Now, if they, I believe Scott Kirby of USA was saying this is a win-win, that. Well, Southwest will get some passengers and they'll get their revenue, but for the legacy airlines that are charging, they'll get this. So we'll see. We'll see what happens now that Southwest has been heavily pushing bags fly free, because, you know, a year ago, if you're not that frequent of a traveler, you may not even know what the airlines are doing. So, or what a specific carrier is doing. So now that Southwest is advertising the hell out of their policies, we'll see if that changes anything.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Airplane Geeks, where we can spend 4 hours talking about whether your bag should fly free or not.
I think bags should fly free.
But did you guys see the comic where the guy walks up to the airline counter and he's got his wife with, and she looks really mean and ugly and nasty, and the woman behind the counter is saying, "No, sir, it's not correct. We said bags fly free, not old bags." Okay, well,
anyway. Yeah, that's good.
Where's that crowd when we need them? All right. Oh, God. Tough crowd.
Oh, this is out of control.
Oh, poor Alan. He's never going to come back. In fact, didn't he?
I think so.
Oh yeah! At least he's still there. He didn't hang up. That's good.
Okay. I'm with you guys. I'm hanging in there.
All right.
Good.
All right. Now for a little public service announcement. According to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the U.S. Department of Transportation has launched the redesigned airconsumer.gov. Except that middle dot of the three is DOT. So it's AIRCONSUMER, Air Consumer. .dot.gov. There's no way to say that well, is there? Now, that has a direct link to the agency's web form for filing complaints about service safety and security or disability and discrimination. Who else finds this really exciting?
I think, considering the fact that I think all of us that fly business aviation feel horribly discriminated against by the airlines, I think this is a good thing.
The thing that amazed me, though, was some of the statistics about the number of complaints. You know, they're trying to make it easier for flyers to file their complaints with the Department of Transportation. So their example is Delta Airlines. They had a total of 95 complaints to the DOT in November of 2009. And I'm thinking, yeah, boy, that is really low. It's hard to believe, only 95. But then you read the next sentence, and it turns out that yeah, but Delta has the highest rate of complaints amongst the 19 airlines ranked, which means that the other 18 have even fewer than that. That just struck me as being incredibly low. I would have guessed much higher numbers of complaints. Sounds like air travelers are not complaining, at least not to the DOT.
Well, part of it is you have to be really angry to actually
tell the government.
I mean, now that they've made the form easier, who knows what will happen. Granted, but they still haven't. They haven't made the actual reports any easier to read. However,
yeah, but there aren't as many people flying either. I mean,
well usually it's
a rate, isn't it?
Yeah, it's per 100,000 right. passengers or something, which is also stupid when they do bags per 100,000 passengers, because what if a passenger has multiple bags? But whatever, I digress.
Uh-huh. Right.
There are lies, there are damn lies, and then there are statistics.
Yeah. Well, you know, 37% of statistics are made up on the spot.
Okay, enough chat about airlines. Let's talk about something really cool like business aviation. What do you think, Alan? Charter. Let's go charter.
Let's all go charter.
Yeah, let's do it. I love it. It's by far the most social way to travel. 28 years of doing this, And I've never had anybody ever tell me that they would love to get out of the Learjet and go back and get on the airline. The only thing I hear is you got to come up with a cheaper way to do this.
Yeah.
But it's definitely nobody complains about the service.
Alan, when you say social, tell us more about that. How do you mean? You say it's the most social way to travel.
Just a much more friendly experience.
Okay.
You got, your pilots. You get in the back of a Hawker or a Falcon or a Learjet, and usually everybody in the back knows everybody else. If not, something's odd is happening.
Yeah.
I've ridden a lot on the airlines, but you can't really conduct business on the airlines. You have to be careful who's sitting behind you or in front of you. A lot of business goes on in the back of business jets. So from that standpoint, when social meaning, I just view the airlines as a very anti-social mm-hmm. experience. And what we do, what business aviation does, whether it's a corporate flight department or a charter flight, is generally, I think, perceived as a really good experience. There's only one negative in all of it, and that's just price that somehow we have to solve.
What's the big driver in price for this kind of travel? Is it operating expense, aircraft operating expenses, or maintenance, or fuel, or manpower? What is it?
Kind of a combination. The fleet of business aircraft are way underutilized. Uh-huh. A typical corporate flight department maybe flies 300-400 hours a year. If you get into the fractional world, they're going to fly maybe 1,200 hours a year on an airplane. And you guys may know this utilization of airlines, but I'm guessing they're more like 3,000 hours a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're spreading a pretty expensive fixed asset over a lot less hours. And of course, it's hard to ever, when you've only got seven seats in the back and you're burning X fuel per hour, it's hard to compete against that 737, with 140 in the back, and you're not burning the multiple of that times of fuel. So kind of is a combination of fixed cost and higher variable cost per seat.
One question, Alan, that I was kind of interested in is concerning, very light jets and, Eclipse and all. The others that have been obviously, slower to take off than at least some people had hoped. What's your view on that? Do you see that as a good thing, a bad thing? Is that a viable business model in your view? Sort of the air taxi kind of approach?
Yeah, I think that ultimately it is. Some of the guys that didn't succeed at that, maybe they were too early in, they were trying to innovate or do something without all the pieces of the puzzle. The guys at Dayjet had a great idea, but it was the wrong airplane. Eclipse, the airplane couldn't do what it needed to do to really be an effective airplane in commercial service. And then I think a lot of, the bigger part of that was just the fact that, I think the guys, when they're promoting that type of taxi service, they're not getting the reach out into the market. So they're, I don't know how to say it, maybe they're operating in silos when they're communicating their supply out to the market. And so even Dayjet, with all the sophisticated software they had, they kept it to themselves. What if they had shared that capability with the entire market, with all the rest of us out there, mm-hmm. so that, you had this synergy of 2,000 charter operators reaching 50 million business travelers. Then you're going to get the right combinations or the right, people getting on, filling up the planes by the seat, so that somebody like a Dayjet or a Sats Air with the Cirruses or any of these other guys that have tried, at some point they have to, you have to get those right combinations to make the money. And, it's still a great idea. It's just, there's just something is not quite there yet.
Hmm.
We've been thinking about that quite a bit.
Hmm. Interesting. Tell us about the Plane Conversations blog. What's the objective? What's the sort of the mission of that blog?
We started thinking about this back in August, and we were trying to understand a new way to communicate to the market. We've always been poor aviators who didn't have money to advertise.
Right.
We kind of started in aviation, so we weren't one of those that started with $5 million to make $1 million. And you know, most of our growth in our business has come from social networking, but more in the sense of the old school, which is you go out and you meet people and you talk to them one-on-one and you develop relationships. And if you do a good job for them by word of mouth, they refer you to their buddies and they end up being your customers. And some of those guys end up buying airplanes they let you manage. So it's been it's kind of an organic thing that's happened over a long period of time. And advertising has always been a very frustrating thing for us. You know, as a guy told me, I know half of my advertising is effective. I just don't know which half.
Yeah.
And so, as I started looking at the social media, you know, it became apparent to me and the people in our company that this is a way to develop relationships via the internet, mm-hmm. In kind of an exponential way. And so, part of that and talking to, some people here in Tennessee who are pretty smart about this stuff, they recommended that we, you know, that we start this blog site. And, you know, back, you know, a year ago, I couldn't have imagined that we would be doing this because, you know, it's quite a bit of effort, and you guys know this. You've been at this a long time, but it's a lot of effort to write.
Sure.
You know,
yeah.
And try to do it well, you know, and not just throw stuff out. So we kind of made a decision back in October. Then I went down to NBAA, and I sat in that the forum that Rob moderated there, and that was kind of the big eye-opener. At that point, maybe we had already put up two or three posts and we were just getting started. But that was the point that said, you know what, this is for real. This is the way the market is. This is the way people are going to communicate to the market, and the market's going to mm-hmm. communicate to them.
And, so you mean to tell me you actually listened to me?
I actually did. Yes, I did.
That's the first time ever.
Yes.
Alan, if you hang around long enough, you'll start ignoring them like we do.
Oh, okay.
Hey,
all right.
Are you going to the scheduler and dispatcher, Alan?
I'm not. Our charter sales manager is going, and she's one of the writers on our blog site. She's an old English major from Mississippi, so she likes writing, and so she's going down there to the schedulers and dispatchers. She was in our scheduling dispatch department, and we put her out to outside sales. They don't let me out very much.
Well, tell her to make sure we're trying to do a different version of that same event we did in Orlando down at scheduler and dispatcher on the Thursday. So tell her to make sure and come by.
I will. She'll make sure to come by and introduce herself to you.
Is she prettier, way prettier than having you around? Would that be a fair statement?
I knew that was coming.
That doesn't take much, guys.
So, Alan, you actually have a number of people who contribute to the blog, right?
I guess there's maybe three or four of us who are, you know, inside or aviation inside people that work at the company. And we've got a couple of guys who contribute who are not aviation guys. They're social media guys who have an interest in aviation. And that's been kind of a fascinating thing for us because it gets an outsider's perspective.
Right, exactly.
Those of us who are in this business tend to not be real creative about thinking about solutions. And you get these guys who are understanding the power of social media, and they start asking these questions, all these what ifs. And it's stuff, you know, it's like, why didn't we think of that?
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, we're trying to, and you know, besides kind of doing some opinion editorial type pieces, we're really trying to ratchet up the conversation about innovation and starting to think about how social media could be used, some type of social media platform could be used to become what I would term as maybe the e-marketplace for private aviation. And mm-hmm. these guys are kind of stimulating that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, did we mention the address for your blog, Alan?
It's plainconversations.com.
Plainconversations.com. Good. I'm going to use you as a resource in my talk.
And it's been pretty exciting. We've been up since the 1st of October. We're putting something out every day and have not run out of steam yet. I've made the decision that if we feel like we can't put something decent up there, you know, we won't post every day.
Right.
But so far, there's, you know, with all this aviation news going on, there's always something you can comment about, especially with the airlines. And we take great pride in poking a stick at the airlines.
Yeah, see, no doubt. I knew I liked this man when he came up in the air. My goodness.
There's an art to poking at them, you know, in kind of a humorous way and not, you know, getting too derogatory. And I have to be a little careful, guys, because I've got a brother who's the CEO of an airline.
But does he have his own blog?
No, he's back there staying quiet. I've asked him to contribute to ours, but he's kind of low key.
Which airline?
He's my brother's CEO of Great Lakes Airline, which is a regional airline based out in Cheyenne, Wyoming. And if you've flown to Telluride or any of those places like that out of Denver, then you've ridden on one of their Beech 1900s.
Alan, how's the economy looking from your perspective? Are you starting to see some recovery, or are we still kind of bouncing along at the bottom?
We're back at about where we were a year and a half ago, and I think before the end of this year, we will be, before the end of 2010, we may be ahead of where we were. But it's hard to determine from our perspective whether that is because, you know, sometimes it's just the last man standing. We've had in our market here in Middle Tennessee, we've had one operator bankrupt. We've had two other significant operators lay off 30-40% of their staff.
Oh,
and
wow.
We were able to hang on to our people. And so now the phones are ringing again. And I'd like to say it's, you know, the economy, but maybe we're just getting a bigger piece of a smaller pie. And, you know, I don't know. What I do know is what I do feel like is charter, you know, the charter part of private aviation will be the first segment to recover, because it's less risky to, financially, to call us and mm-hmm. book a trip tomorrow than it is to go back and start an aviation flight department again.
One last question, maybe. How did you get started in this business? Were you a passionate aviator since, you know, you were six, or what was your path to come to this place?
I was born into an aviation family. I have my father started flying about, I'm turned 50 this year, and he's been flying for 55 years. And so, he was, you know, we were small town airport. Dad was at a small town airport, and he was a crop duster, and he ran a flight school, and crop dusting in the '60s was a pretty high hazard occupation. And that lasted 3 years. And then he got into corporate aviation. And so I grew up around it. It was one of those things where I went to school went to college to get a degree in marketing, thinking that I was going to be out of aviation and sell computers, you know, go to work for IBM. Mm-hmm. And then somewhere in there, I fell back into it. And in the early 80s, when we started our business, it was really dad had lost his job, a corporate aviation job, and I was an unemployed college graduate. And, you know, what else, you know, if you can't get a job, then you get into aviation. So
sure, yeah.
It's been I wouldn't have envisioned that 28 years ago we would be where we are today. It's been a fun ride, though.
That's terrific. That's wonderful. All right. Well, we want to leave time for our little word association game. I'm not sure, Alan, if you're familiar with that, but what we typically do for our first-time guests is put out a word or a phrase and just ask you to start talking about the first thing that pops into your head.
Now, is this a psychological evaluation, or
it's only a psychological evaluation of the co-hosts?
Oh, okay,
not of you.
The chances of you failing this are very slim.
Yeah, no one has ever failed this.
Ah, the pressure.
Except when we were asked the questions, we bombed.
That's right. We did have the tables turned on us once. So
if I bomb, then I become one of the hosts, right?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's your. Okay. That's the penalty for.
This guy is very clever.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. That's why he's a successful businessman. Who's got the first word?
Social media.
Social media. It's and I'm just supposed to give you a couple of words or whatever or comes to my mind.
Whatever comes to your mind.
It's the new way for for businesses and buyers to communicate.
Have you found, just one quick question though, Al, have you found it taking you in directions that you never expected it to?
You know, we're a little bit new at it, but I think that, you know, one thing I've found is we're meeting people that we would have never met any other way. And, that's really fascinating to me. So, and I think ultimately, in some sense, you become a communications company as much as you are a service provider. Not that we'll ever, you know, see ourselves as a media company or whatever, but it's also forced me to think about what we do, because when you write it and it's out there forever, you need to think about what you're saying. You know, I can shoot off the cuff all day long, but when I write it and I put it out into the blogosphere, I have to think more about what we're doing. So it's a good mental challenge.
And you're supposed to say fairly good things about the airlines. You're not just supposed to make fun of them, you're saying, right?
I wrote one post that just said, hey, broken system, but good people.
Yeah.
There's a lot of good people. I have a lot of friends, pilots who fly in the airlines, and a lot of customer service people. I've had, you know, a lot of positive experiences. But you know that, if I had any criticism of those guys, it'd be more at the leadership level.
David, have you got a word or a phrase?
Okay, I'm going to take the Rob technique and use more than one word. Favorite ride?
Favorite ride is Learjet 20 series.
Rocket.
And what Rocket is it about jet. That, the speed?
You know, we don't operate them anymore, but we had a 24D one time, and there's no greater experience than getting in a Lear 24 light on fuel, go up for a test flight, and just go straight to 45,000 feet. And then do the emergency descent and come back down faster than you went up.
Sound of that.
You know, and I'm not a Lear pilot. They don't let me fly those airplanes. I'm a Cirrus Baron captain, but it sure is fun sitting in the back of one of those airplanes.
Cool. All right, Dan, have you got a word for Alan?
Oh, I'm trying to think with him mentioning airline leadership. So I'm going to take a crapshoot and go with the name. So Glenn Tilton.
Glenn Tilton is the
CEO of United, and right now heading up the ATA.
Okay. You know, I read something he said, and he's the first guy, first airline executive to admit that the airlines do really stupid stuff. I thought that was cool. He said, I think the term was self-destructive business behavior. And kind of an expansion of that is back to that the earlier conversation about pricing. Why do these guys continually increase capacity to the point where they put themselves in a situation that they have to price themselves to lose money? And I think that's what he was referring to. But I thought, you know, finally, there's a guy who's owning up to and not blaming, you know, general aviation or the government or everybody else, and just saying, hey, you know, we're not doing things right. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Very good. All right, I have one word. Safety.
Safety. I think that our industry is doing a pretty good job at that. You guys probably read a little bit about, I'm starting to get up to speed on ISBAO that the NBAA is pushing. We're, you know, the whole SMS, safety management system push, and I think that's a good thing.
Okay, well, very good. Is there anything else that we didn't cover that you'd like to bring up?
You know, something that, you know, maybe at some point in the next few months I can get back with you guys, and that is in regards to this use of social media and private aviation. We're really putting a lot of mental effort into that with some technology guys. Hoping that that there's a technology out there that would allow, let me think how to best say this, that would create a social grid or a social media platform, and how LinkedIn and Facebook and all these sites work. If you can envision that same type of social technology applied to the business traveler and private aviation, where outside of the supply side of this business, the market could aggregate demand, And if the market aggregates demand, then you can effectively sell charter service by the seat because the market would come together. You know, you guys all get together and say, hey, we want to charter my Learjet and go somewhere, and you didn't know each other, but social technology puts you together because you have similar travel patterns.
Right.
And so we're kind of looking at some way to try to innovate that. And technology is there. Just had the pieces of the puzzle had to be put together.
How effective do you think that the software that's left over from the Dayjet operation would be in that kind of a
That's interesting
situation,
idea.
Alan?
I don't know. I know that they spent a lot of money on that, and I have a feeling that if that a lot of that software that those algorithms that they had, if that was applied to the macro level of the market, you know, and if you could envision that all 2,000 charter operators broadcast their supply into a system, and then however many business travelers have an interest and having an alternative to the airlines could go into that system and look at all that, and then not only look at it, but could communicate with each other before they go to the market to buy, then I think that there may be some technology that's already sitting there. Those guys just kept it to themselves, and that's been a little bit of a problem of our industry is I think everybody it's hard for this industry to get together because you can't get everybody to agree on anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like, yeah, there's a lot of opportunity to pull something together like that. Interesting idea.
Yeah, thank you. We'll keep you posted on that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's Alan Howell. Again, thank you for joining us. Alan's the CEO of Corporate Flight Management. I guess that website is www.flycfm.com, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct, uh-huh.
And Plane Conversations, you can find that at www.planeconversations.com. Alan, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Alan.
Okay, thank you, guys. I appreciate
Bye,
it.
Bye, Alan.
And now with This Week in Aviation, it's David Vanderhoof, the official Airplane Geeks historian.
Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 2, Episode 2, January 17th through the 23rd. January 17th, 1991, at 2:45 a.m. Baghdad time, Operations Desert Shield, Granby, Daggett, Friction, and Locusta became Operation Desert Storm. Began quietly on the western desert of Iraq, Task Force Normandy, four MH-53 Pavlo III helicopters, lead a series of eight AH-64s to take out a series of radars to make a corridor to Baghdad. Simultaneously over Baghdad, Major Greg Feast, call sign Bandit 261, released a 2,000-pound laser-guided bomb from F-117A, Alpha Fox 850816, the Lone Wolf. Feast was charged with taking out the AT&T building in the middle of downtown Baghdad. By the end of the night, coalition air forces had dropped 18,000 tons of bombs, with 655 aircraft completing 1,332 sorties, with a loss of only three aircraft. January 18th, 1911. Our friend Eugene Eli returns this time, except this time he's landing on a ship. Eli landed his Curtis Pusher biplane on the deck of the USS Pennsylvania, anchored in San Francisco Harbor. He did use a tailhook, and that was the first use of a tailhook. When asked about the procedure, Eli quipped, "It was easy enough. I think the trick could be successfully turned 9 times out of 10. January 18th, 1957, Operation Power Flight takes 3 B-52Bs of the 93rd Bomb Group around the world, completing the first circumnavigation of the world by jet. The flight covered 24,325 miles in 45 hours and 19 minutes. The mission was to demonstrate Strategic Air Command's strategic global reach with aerial refueling. Lastly, January 21st, 1970, Pan Am inaugurated commercial service of the Boeing 747-100, the flight from JFK to Heathrow. However, the 747-121 Clipper Young America N-733PA became unserviceable due to an engine flameout. Clipper Victor N-736PA was quickly pressed into service and repainted and renamed Clipper Young America for the flight, so it would still match the press releases.
Oh, no.
The flight arrived at Heathrow on January 22nd of 1970. First flights that occurred during the week. On January 19th, 1946, the Bell XS-1 first flew. And for our neighbors up north, on January 19th, 1950, the Canadair CF-100 Canuck Jet Interceptor first flew.
Hmm.
And that's the way it was, January 17th through January 23rd.
Thank you, David.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, January 17th, 2010.
Well, it is 2010 still, and g'day folks, it's Steve Vischer here, and Grant McHaren joins me once again live in studio this week. And Grant, we didn't even have to abduct you this week. How impressive.
Yeah, it's amazing what happens when the kids decide they want to get together and someone's got to be the taxi driver.
Oh, and the mention of free food.
Yeah, that always works too.
Yeah, well, we've had a couple of very peaceful weeks here in the Vischer household because my two kids have been away up in Sydney at the Scout Jamboree for the last 2 weeks. It's been lovely and quiet, but there's been a disturbance in the force, Grant, and they have returned to us, and there is a lot of ambient noise in the background today. Let's just say that much.
Yeah, no, it's your kids, my kid, and a couple other kids, and they're all having fun down the other end of the house, but as is true with kitties, you can hear them up hit this end as well.
Yeah. Okay, a few stories that we'll just cover for you quickly this week, and Grant, we're actually going to do this one vaguely sound effect free.
Yeah, we're threatening to turn off Steve's sound effect computer because we don't want Max and the guys to get upset with us.
First one we're going to look at this week, folks, we're talking about Jetstar Pacific, which is the Jetstar offshoot that operates in Vietnam, and the Transport Workers Union, which is a fairly sizable labour union here in Australia, has launched an investigation into some maintenance practices that are taking place, allegedly, up there in Vietnam with Jetstar Pacific.
That's right. Jetstar Pacific is 27% owned by Qantas. The rest of it is owned by the Vietnamese government, and a safety audit was recently released from the Civil Aviation Authority of Vietnam, finding there were a number of violations involving potential hazards that could lead to safety threats at Jetstar Pacific. So the TWU is flexing its muscle and diving in to have a look at this. I think it's a little interesting that they're getting so stuck into Jetstar. We've got some quotes from Steve Pavinas that we'll read out in a second. People are making a lot of waves over this because... hello, Australia only owns 30% of it. It's less than 30%. And yes, the aircraft are branded Jetstar. That we have talked about this a couple of times in the past, Jetstar Pacific. They look like Jetstar planes. People think they're Jetstar planes, but they're actually 70% Vietnamese. So I'm dubious about what's causing all this, and the fact that the TWU is saying, oh, CASA should really have been all over this, the Australian Aviation Safety Authority. The planes, I don't think, even come to Australia.
Why should they?
They fly purely in Asia. It's all Jetstar Pacific. It's not a pure Qantas operation.
Now, the interesting thing here is that the National Secretary of the TWU, Tony Sheldon, said that the union is planning to send representatives over to Vietnam to verify the authority's findings. Now, what's prompted this has been some reports from a couple of whistleblowers who were allegedly discovered by the airline and had their employment terminated as a result.
It was a couple of maintenance engineers imported from Australia and from New Zealand who were working on the systems, and they raised some issues and are no longer working there.
Yeah, now there's been a lot of union coverage in general in this country about the maintenance practices of all the airlines here, and Qantas has not escaped the gaze of the labour unions here. I guess that's nothing unusual in the grand scheme of things. We know that sort of thing happens all over the world. The interesting quote here, just looking on the Transport Workers Union website, is that they're saying they're motivated by the Australianism. They're saying that Qantas is an Australian icon with the majority owned by the Australian community, and we do not want to see its brand being cheapened because its executives are putting bonuses before their safety and security. Good old-fashioned union public relations talk there. And, of course, Qantas, although we do often joke that Qantas is part of the Jetstar group, but we all know really it's the other way around officially. Maybe this is just another way of leveraging a bit more pressure onto Qantas to pursue the union agenda.
Those two engineers, they were trying to raise issues for the Australian management. They were fired by Jetstar Pacific. It's not necessarily indicating that they were fired by the Australians. They could have been fired by some of the Vietnamese crew in there. CAV, the Civil Aviation Authority of Vietnam, has ordered Jetstar Pacific to stand down the Australian maintenance manager David Andrew and the Bulgarian technical quality manager Atanas Stankov. It's getting pretty interesting. Jetstar has actually rejected the findings of that report. This issue is going to get worse, I think, before it gets better here. It's either going to suddenly disappear, but I doubt the union's going to let that happen. I think we're going to find that it's going to get progressively worse as time goes on, and Qantas may find that this 30% ownership in Vietnam may be a bit too hot for it to handle.
They're certainly having a very bumpy ride with that relationship with the Vietnamese carrier at the moment. We've reported previously in our show about two of their top executives who are Australian citizens being prevented from leaving Vietnam at the moment. They haven't been arrested, but they're certainly not allowed to leave Vietnam pending a number of investigations into a $31 million US dollar loss against some fuel hedging. And we've also reported before that there's been a lot of ill will politically towards the idea of Jetstar Pacific running, or the Vietnamese carrier running around in Jetstar colours. You know, it looks and feels for all the world like it's an Australian branded plane, when in fact it's a Vietnamese plane. So yeah, I think there's a bit of political pride going on up there in Vietnam.
Yeah,
and I agree with you, Grant. I wonder if Qantas is really looking at that now and saying, gee whiz, maybe that was a mistake, maybe we shouldn't have gone there after all.
It's going to be interesting for them, that's for sure. The TWU is definitely going to hold them to task, because as you said, people think they're an Australian airline. So the TWU's angle is like, well, hey, you're an Australian airline, we're going to treat you like Australians and give you a good going through. And then you've got the other side of it, which is, well, actually, it's majority Vietnamese owned. We can't control the Vietnamese. We're just in there to help advise and grow and boost our shares. You know, it's they may get caught right in the middle of all that.
Well, one thing's for certain, mate, that's certainly going to generate a lot of news for us to report on in the coming months. There's not much doubt about that. Something else that's caught our eye recently is a little bit of an incident involving a United Airlines Boeing 747 that was en route from Los Angeles to Sydney. Grant, it's had to make a quick diversion to Brisbane on the way over.
Yeah, that's right. It's being reported that it's had a mechanical issue, not that it was facing headwinds and had to stop to refuel. It's actually stopped in Brisbane, and another aircraft is staged up from Sydney to pick up the passengers and bring them down to Sydney. And the aircraft is apparently still in Brisbane. So that does indicate that it's not just a headwinds top me up with fuel and on I go to Sydney kind of scenario. There may actually be some issue with the aircraft. Either it was creating more drag, so they burnt more fuel getting down, or it was a cross-feed kind of problem where they couldn't get to the fuel in one of the tanks and weren't able to continue on to Sydney.
Been a lot of speculation about what might have gone wrong with this flight. We're looking at some of the great gossip websites such as Prune, and all sorts of speculation there as to what it might have been. United Airlines hasn't really been forthcoming with any information other than to say it's diverted for a ramp service issue or something similar like that, something which doesn't really mean anything.
Well, the only other possibility we can see is that it was a headwinds, it was running out of fuel, it landed, and after landing had a mechanical issue or some mechanical fault come up that prevented the aircraft from continuing on. Don't think it would have been related to crew time durations at that stage, unless they got held on the ramp in Brisbane for a very long time.
Generally, what happens with most of those United aircraft that operate to Sydney, they then operate down to Melbourne. I'm not sure if this was one such flight, but that's generally the way I think they operate down here.
One part of the amusing media aspect to this story was the Sydney Morning Herald, I believe it was, had an article on its webpage talking about it, and they used the file footage of the United Airlines aircraft that had the landing gear collapse recently. So they're showing that as if it's a major issue in Brisbane, and oh my god, another aircraft's crashed, when really it was the wrong kind of aircraft and totally different kind of situation. So they've now replaced it with another photo of a 777 saying a United Airlines airliner.
And yes, Dan, before you say anything, we know they don't operate 777s across here. So that's what we find the most amusing. They've stuck a picture of a 777 in their little photo block there, when in actual fact the aircraft involved is a 747-400. So, all right, mate, and just before we finish up for this week, we're going to cross over the Tasman and talk about our friends over there at Air New Zealand. They've been winning some awards again.
That's right. Air Transport World, the leading monthly magazine covering the global airline industry, according to itself, has announced the selection of Air New Zealand as its Airline of the Year for 2010. I like it. We haven't even got into 2010 yet, and they're already the airline.
Woohoo! Yeah, gee.
Maybe Air Transport World have a crystal ball or a TARDIS and can see what's coming up, or more likely, it really was for 2009, but they call it 2010 based on 2009. They awarded Air New Zealand the honour because of its superb commitment to safety and operational excellence, typified by the use of performance-based navigation cockpit technology at weather and terrain-challenged destinations. That's Queenstown for most people.
Yeah.
And for its superb and groundbreaking customer service that combines high-tech, passenger-friendly IT systems, when IBM aren't taking them offline, and caring staff. So pretty good. Well done, Air New Zealand. Congratulations on winning that award. That's great. And I will just point out very briefly that Sydney-based Regional Express, a.k.a. Rex, was also named Regional Airline of the Year. So we've been following them for a while. Congratulations to both Air New Zealand and Rex for getting those gongs.
There was a lot of scepticism when that partnership came about to create that airline. You know, a lot of negative speculation about how long they'd last. But, you know, they've been around for quite some years now, Grant, and they're doing some great things operating into some of our bigger regional centres, you know, which is a really important thing in this country. We've had a lot of cutbacks in other modes of transport, such as railways in particular. The regional carriers have, in many cases, stepped in to fill that gap, and Rex does that job really well, so it's great to see. The other thing that we should mention about Air New Zealand, Grant, you just touch briefly there on the uniform issue. We became aware of their proposed new uniforms from a link that Dan sent to us. And really, mate, we took one look at that, and all we could really say was...
Oh, a sound effect snuck in.
I had to give one, but I'll tell you what, they're shocking. Well, that's about everything we have for you this week, folks. We're just going to enjoy a little bit of peace and quiet before the kids come in here. And...
Oh, no,
oh my goodness, out of here, all of you, out.
Oh.
Back, child. Back. Down. Down.
Down, child.
Down.
Quick. Where's my wife? Give them some more food. Quickly.
Raw meat. Raw meat required.
All right, folks. Well, if we survive this, we'll be back with you next week. I'm Steve Fisher.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
Cheers, folks.
That was very good.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's interesting when they were talking about the Jetstar execs that are being held in Vietnam. I listened to their last podcast, and they go into it in a little bit more details, but it's kind of a scary thing. I mean, what they're basically saying is that if, you know, it's part of the culture, even though there were these losses due to fuel hedging, because there's losses, there has to be an investigation. And because there's an investigation, the parties involved can't leave the country. So they're figuring these poor guys are going to have to spend the next couple of months cooling their heels in Vietnam.
You mentioned holding on to these guys every time a company had a loss. Oh, my Lord.
If I was an airline executive, I certainly wouldn't think of spending a whole lot of time in Vietnam.
One thing, just on another topic, was that what Air New Zealand did because of that award, which was very nice, everyone gets an extra day off, which was, I thought, was a nice move.
Oh, how nice. Okay, on to the listener mail. We had listener Austin. He called in from Korea and left us a great voicemail.
Hello, guys, from South Korea. My name is Austin Bowman, and I'm stationed here as a U.S. Army Blackhawk flight engineer. And I'm just proud to say I'm probably the biggest airplane geek fan on the Korean Peninsula. I'm an avid listener of the podcast, and it certainly is a great way to hear all things aviation in one podcast, which keeps me up to date during the busy the work week. But anyway, general aviation here is really nothing close to what is back in the States. However, they do have an Air Force Aero Club here, where you can rent a Cessna for $72 an hour and about $11 an hour for the instructor. But anyways, please continue to work. Please continue to make these awesome podcasts, and I look forward to future episodes of Dan getting pestered by Mr. Turn a New Leaf, Rob Mark. And I hope you guys take care. Bye-bye.
Oh, thanks to Austin for that. We love listener voicemail.
Turning over a new leaf. See, I love this. Austin, thank you. I mean, see, someone is recognizing the effort that I have made to become more professional. I mean, not just your standard old crunching on snacks during the show and breathing hard and doing all kinds of just really obnoxious things.
This really did seem like a snack-free show.
Like Dan.
Well, well, is a dog with you this time, though, Rob?
Yeah. Well, no, actually, no, he's not here tonight. I left him home. No.
Drive to your office to record this thing?
Yeah.
You can't do it at home?
Well, I could, but then I'd have all
the noise.
Home,
that's when the peanuts, the popcorn.
That's where all the food is.
That's probably right. Yes. So it's not far though. So it's okay.
We also got a note from Jamie. Jamie says that he thought you might enjoy the radial ceiling fan. For more radial engine gadgets, see radialclassics.com. This is pretty interesting. Basically, what this company does is, among other things, is they take old radial engines and they turn them into something else. An example being a ceiling fan. So if you're of the mind to get some real aircraft memorabilia inside your house, you can consider one of these things. They're not cheap, and you got to find a way to hang a pretty heavy object from your ceiling. But
they want a cheap airplane memorabilia, they could have me for a lot less.
Yeah, you're cheap. Yeah. All right. You know, that's pretty good, David. Very good.
How much does this thing weigh, though?
135 pounds. It's not a full engine. And I think they remove internals that add weight but are not visible so as to lighten the thing.
Not what you want to put over your...
No. And they're not cheap, too. This is like in the $5,000 range, so...
That's nothing. Yeah. I'll just put on the Airplane Geeks tab.
Great. Along with everything else. Kim sent in a note and had quite a lot to say, some good comments. He did have a comment on what Chris Elliott said last episode, that passengers will put up with anything to save a buck, says, I can only add my fervent amen.
That's it? He called all the way in just to say amen?
Well, he said a little more than that, too. He said that as websites proliferated, listing services between city pairs in the order of increasing fare, the travel agency business crashed and the public became able for the first time to view all fares themselves. I had occasion during meetings with airline execs to see definitive proof that a fare increase as small as $5 would significantly affect market share on a route. It's a good thing that the public is willing to accept any level of service without complaint, because it is their cheap ticket obsession that has resulted in the crashing decline of airline service in the U.S. They're getting what they're willing to pay for.
No, that's a great point, and that's why, I mean, everyone complains about Ryanair over in Europe, but everyone comes back because it's so cheap.
You're right. That's it, absolutely. Kim continues, Rob, I can't believe you stooped so low as to correct David on the pronunciation of aviation. But as long as you did, I'll join in the fun and inform Dan. Now, see, he said Dan, but I think he means David. Me. That the term N number is stated just as it reads. No one ever substitutes the phonetic alphabet's November for the N in that term to say November than the number. Sorry, couldn't resist. Great show, guys. Thanks, Kim.
You know, I don't know, David. What do you think? Maybe we don't need the guy.
Wow.
Oh, you're changing your mind, huh?
No, I think enough. You know? Enough typing. It's easier to talk. It really is. Yeah. Come on.
We'll have to get in touch with Kim.
Yeah.
All right. So I think that's it. Thanks again to our guest, Alan Howell. He's the CEO of Corporate Flight Management, and he's also part of the team on the Plane Conversations blog. You can find that at www.planeconversations.com. As always, thanks to Steve Fisher and Grant McCarron for sending us their Australia desk. Be sure to follow those guys at planecrazydownunder.com, and I've said it before, and I'll keep saying it. You don't have to be from that region in order to enjoy the show that those guys have. All right, so David, tell us where people can find you online.
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof, or you can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.blogspot.com, and occasionally you can find me on the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Yes. And Dan, how about you? Where do people find you?
Well, you can find Dan Webb at things in the sky. I'm sorry. I'm just having so much fun with this program. At thingsinthesky.com. And you can find me on Twitter at Dan Webbage. And just because I got an email from a listener saying, apparently, it's a weird nickname. So DanWebbage on Twitter.
Also known as Dan Webbage.
Yes.
Okay.
Have we ever asked you why you're Dan Webbage?
Well, Dan Webb was taken, and then in high school, someone just started calling me Webbage. So I just, you know.
It stuck.
See. Okay.
All right. And Rob, tell us where people can find you.
Well, they online, can find
I don't think we want to find you otherwise, but.
No. Listen, and as I said earlier, I mean, I put your name in the TSA survey, so I'm going to sleep real well tonight.
You're such a pal.
I know. Jetwine.com is the place where Scott Spangler and I hang out and write about all kinds of fun stuff aviation-wise. And, of course, Jetwine on Twitter. And I think we'll mention that we're going to be down at the NBAA Scheduler and Dispatcher Conference in San Antonio week after next. And obviously some of the folks that listen are probably going to be down there. So come on down and say hi and pick up your Jetwine button.
Yeah, and try to get some...
I have mine.
Try to get some good photos of Rob, you know, really embarrassing ones, and send them in.
Yeah, get some action shots.
That's it.
How did you get a Jetwine badge?
It was in the Christmas cards that Rob sent.
Oh, I see where I rank now.
I have one, too.
You didn't get one, David? I thought I put one in your card.
No, that's okay.
Well, you'll have to correct that, Rob.
That's okay. Yeah. I get stuff from the guys who really care.
Yeah, okay.
All right, and I'm Max Flight. You can find me at 30,000feet.com or on Twitter.
Hey, Max, where can we find you?
On Twitter, at Max Flight. Be sure to visit all of us at the airplanegeeks.com website. You find show notes, links to the news stories we've discussed, and you can leave a comment, and you can even order your very own Airplane Geeks t-shirt. Follow the Airplane Geeks on Twitter. We're at Airplane Geeks. If you want to send us email, that's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Or even better, you can leave us a message on our listener line.
What's that number?
Or more specifically,
if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Thanks,
Benet. I was just going to say, more specifically, complaints@jetwine.com.
All complaints go to Rob.
Yeah, they do anyway. That's all right.
All right, join us next week. Next week we have, are we going to say, we have something special?
Well, I don't know. I think we should surprise everybody when they tune in.
But they got to tune in ahead of time to be on the show.
So you need to follow us on Twitter to see if something's happening or not.
Right, which may be live. So if you are looking forward to, ahead into your schedule for next week, try to keep next Sunday.
Sunday.
At 8 p.m. Eastern, open.
If you want to hear something really cool, we're going to do something and we'll tell you on Twitter.
There you go.
Or check our blogs. We'll all be blogging.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
Except that guy in South Korea.
Hey, okay. I think we should have press release about this. Maybe, Rob, you can get on Fox News and talk about it.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Sarah Palin and I are doing a show next week. So
you know, keep building this up so big, and you know, you're setting the bar pretty high. People are going to have expectations that I hope we can live up to.
Tune in next week when the Airplane Geeks fall flat on their face.
Tune in next week for crushing disappointment.
I'm not going to end it on that note. We can't.
Oh, good night, everybody. Thank you for listening.
Thanks, everybody.
Night, I mean,
yeah,
good night, everyone.
Good night, everybody.
Dan, stop breathing into the mic.
I'm not breathing into the mic.
Okay. Somebody is.
Not me.
Can't be me. I've been on mute.
Okay.
Haven't you guys noticed, though, how good I have been lately? No chewing.
I know.
Scratching. No.
Your sound quality isn't as good, though.
Oh,
you do sound a little distant.
Well, that's just kind of my personality.
A little different. All right.
Okay, is this better?
Yes, actually.
Oh, okay.
All right, who's breathing into the mic?
Not me.
Somebody's breathing into the mic.
It was probably me. I'm sorry. It's my fault, and we'll work on it and get back to you.
Great.